This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Here's another Saturday Magazine podcast brought to you by Joy sponsor, Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
A unique mix of world news and queer culture, Saturday Magazine, every Saturday, 10 till 12, on Joy 94.9.
Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9. Macca here, Matt Wade, editor of Star Observer, is in the studio, as is Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation. What an interesting first week. Matt and I were talking about it just earlier, Misha, the first week of the campaign. I've said that I thought probably the Libs were a little bit ahead. I thought Morrison had performed well, but then again, I didn't have to endure many of his vox pops. But I think Bill Shorten's misstep on super damaged them. The issues that are important got a lot of coverage. I mean, what's your assessment of the first week?
Yeah, I think the misstep on super didn't help Shorten, but if you're going to make a mistake, now's the time to make it.
Now's the time to do it, yeah.
Particularly, you know, before the Easter long weekend, we've got this sort of little period where we've got a little break. And even, I think, next week, things are going to be relatively slow. So, you know, I mean, you know, obviously you don't want to fumble, you don't want to make mistakes. By the same token, there still is a widespread perception that many in the electorate are quite disengaged.
Yes.
Have either made up their minds or aren't engaging yet in the detail. And if you look really at the substance of the first week, I don't think there wasn't a massive amount that came out of it. So I don't think you'd read too much into it.
What do you attribute that disengagement to? Like, are people kind of like, what's the reason behind that?
Well, I think there's a couple of theories or a couple of things going on. It's different for different groups of people. There is a perception that there are some who have made up their minds. They're frustrated with the coalition, and they're angry or disappointed about particular things, a range of issues, and those people sort of know how they're going to vote. There's also, I think, a bit of a perception that at the moment what's being offered is not, you know, a wide array of policy discussion. It's very narrow in terms of, you know, policies around sort of taxation, the economy. We haven't seen a big breadth of issues. The idea generally is that you want to try to engage voters at the level of what's in it for me, how's it going to affect me, but it's actually quite incremental, it's quite small, very technical, the differences are very small, it's very hard to get your head around.
Now, I'm not going to ask you how or who you will vote for, but do you feel comfortable where you think you're going to vote currently?
That's a strange question.
Have you actually decided how you're going to vote?
Are we resolute? Like, we know where we're heading? Yeah. I mean, you can go first, Misha. I don't know.
Well, I mean, for me, the way I've been thinking about this issue, I mean, obviously there's a range of issues, but for me the most fundamental issue is the people on Manus and Nauru.
Yeah.
I feel like it's such an issue for Australia sort of in terms of our moral authority as a nation, like who we are, that I sort of can't countenance that situation continuing. So my vote will be based on whatever is most likely to see a resolution to the situation for those people.
And what electorate do you live in, Misha?
I live in... that's a good question, actually. I'm not quite sure the technical name. I live in Brunswick. I think it's Wills, yeah.
Wills, okay.
Yeah. I'm in Richmond, which is Melbourne. Yes.
Yes.
I'm pretty resolute, I think. I think it would take quite a bit to change who I'll vote for. But it is interesting, as you pointed out, over the past week, it's kind of been very specific issues that they've been talking about. It hasn't been really a wide breadth of topics covered. I mean, I anticipate that might change in the coming weeks and the lead up to the actual date. But we were talking earlier, Macca and I, that, I mean, specifically around LGBTI issues, often they don't really get much airtime because, all the focus is put on whether it's taxes or economy, that kind of stuff. So it'll be interesting to see if we kind of get more diversity in the coming weeks.
I live in Bill Shorten's electorate.
Right.
I'm right on the cusp. Actually, I moved, but I'm still in there. I'm right on the cusp. And contrary to public opinion, I haven't actually decided how I'm going to vote yet. If you want to put money on it, you might be okay. but no, you could easily lose it.
Mm.
But it will be for one of three parties. That's as close as I would get.
Well, that narrows it down.
It does a bit. I think the first week has been interesting because we've seen there is a lot of fake news out there. Most recently, it was overnight. I don't know whether Josh Frydenberg tweeted it, but someone did. You know, a story that Labor and the Greens have done a deal to reintroduce death duties, which is not true. Not true. And all that happens there is it just needs to get out there on social media, and then all of a sudden it becomes, oh my God, you know. But it's actually not true. I think the next week, yeah, because we've got Easter and we've got Anzac Day, no doubt Anzac Day there'll be lots of Polly's wrapping themselves in the flag, talking about, you know, our fantastic history in that area. But I wonder again whether people are engaged, because I don't think people are engaged.
I think one thing that's interesting is, and Michelle Grattan was writing about this earlier this week, the extent to which the advertising, particularly online, is actually quite negative, as opposed to the mainstream television advertising, which is more circumspect and more positive. Mm. And obviously as the media changes and, you know, TV ratings are down and people are consuming more of their content online, that idea of sowing seeds of misinformation, putting ideas out there and having them able to get circulation or get traction is actually very effective. So I just think that's actually something really to watch because, of course, we've got a very different regulatory regime for online publishing than we do for what we would call, you know, mainstream media. And there's sort of different battles going on, I think.
And it's very much, you know, as we've seen, and we'll touch on it, the Mueller report, that online is very, very different, and how you can target particular messages and particular ads at a particular group of people. And the lack of regulation there, you know, the Electoral Commission, you know, Australian Electoral Commission is trying very hard to call out bad instances, but the problem is often it's after it's happened and people have already clicked on it and
it's already influenced people's opinion, even if it's not.
So I think, yeah, it is a very different environment, and I think, in my assessment, is that the on-ground campaigns in the electorates, you know, outside the train stations, doing the door-knocking, Labor and the Greens have always been better at that. The Liberals have always struggled in that area to some degree. And online, I would still say that in terms of a positive reinforcement of policies, I think Labor and Liberal really need to lift their game. There's not enough detail there, but their targeting, you know, is pretty blatant.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, I mean, the problem with detail, of course, is that you can get bogged down into it. So although I agree that, you know, on many of the policies, we do need to see more detail. We need to know what's actually going to happen. It's always a very delicate balance because, you know, you can get lost in that. And also it's a very good chance to make mistakes.
So if you have a question for Misha or Matt or for me, on air at joy.org.au or 0427JOY949 on SMS. What do you guys think are the key issues? You mentioned asylum seekers, Misha. But from a broader perspective, outside the bubbles we all live in, what do you think are the issues that the electorate could be swayed on if they're an undecided vote?
I think climate change has been getting a lot of traction. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we've seen amazing media coverage of that, even pre-campaign with, you know, people taking to the streets, kids at schools, which obviously affects families. I think climate change is a big one.
I think there's sort of a demand, if you look in the electorate, for policies that will support health services in particular. Is very important. Education is very important. Those things that actually are really going to directly touch people's lives.
Mm.
There was a good piece actually in the Age newspaper today talking about the lack of debate and discussion on climate change.
Yeah.
I think one of the issues with climate change in an election campaign context is the level of abstraction when what the politicians are trying to do is speak specifically to how are these policies going to change your world in the next, you know, months and years going forward. So I think that although it would be good to see a lot more climate change discussion, it's a harder issue to deal with in a campaign context.
I was saying earlier to Paul and Pete on Saturday Sessions that I had a bit of a penny dropped moment last night. I was sitting outside in the yard late at night, and I'd bought some new couple little solar lights, and they were actually ones that I'd had previously were pretty crappy, pretty dreadful, and these are pretty good. Make quite a decent amount of light, and I was just looking at it and I thought, how could you be against solar energy or renewable energy? Here's something that is providing enough light in my backyard and it's free. Okay, I bought the light and it's got the battery. So, as I said, it was a penny drop moment. I thought, you know, in terms of heavy industry and stuff, yes, baseload power is a big issue. But, you know, renewable energy, the uptake of solar in Australia and others, and in Germany, one in every two solar installations now has battery storage. So we have day solar, then you have storage. Storage is the key. But it was like, how could you not think about this issue? How could you be against renewable energy? People are, but, you know, farmers, for example, in Germany, when you drive through Germany, through the German countryside, on every single building and barn and everything, there are solar panels. And people actually rent their roof space out to investors to put the panels on because of the incentives and the feedback tariffs and et cetera. But yeah, it was an interesting moment, and I wonder whether the electorate, you know, until they actually, you know, a lot of people think about it, sure, there's big issues like Adani and others, but renewable energy, how has it become such a negative for so many people? I don't get it.
I think the answer to that really is the political power of fear. Politics works on a very emotional level. We have an adversarial system where generally on any issue, even if there's a very strong argument for behaving one way or the other, there's a counter-argument you can make.
Yeah.
And if that counter-argument is built around fear, particularly fear of losing some economic advantages or other things that sort of give you a position in society, then that can be quite powerful. And I think there have been particularly, you know, very strong elements within the coalition, in particular within the National Party, that have been very strong about supporting the coal industry and creating this sense of fear about loss if we adopt these types of policies. So, I mean, there's two separate questions. There's the rational question, which is if you look at it, what will it get us? What are the costs? And it's very hard rationally to be opposed, for example, to solar energy. There's nothing wrong with it. There's no losers. But the emotional argument is also powerful, and we have to sort of pay attention to that, I think.
You are on Saturday Magazine with Macca, Matt Wade from Star Observer, Misha Ketchell from the Coalition. Listener John has said, I think it's quite obvious that the three of you guys won't be voting for the Coalition. Well, I can't speak for the others. For me, it's not about politics, it's about policy. And if the Coalition come up with a convincing policy for me that gets me across the line, then I will vote for them. Currently, neither of the three parties have secured my vote.
And I should also add that it probably goes without saying, but whenever we put up a story that's political on the Star Observer, there's often a diverse range of commenters that support Labor and Liberal. The community is not as homogenous as, you know.
It's not. Now, we've got a quick question. Do Tim Wilson's comments supporting Israel Folau, does this help or hinder his campaign? Enjoying the show whilst on holidays, help or hinder his campaign? I think Tim knows how to campaign, and I think the people of Goldstein will make a decision based on how he's represented them.
But yeah, just for anyone that maybe wasn't aware, in relation to Israel Folau's recent comments, Tim Wilson said that he didn't think that Folau's comments crossed a line, and he felt that, you know, everyone should be able to deliver their religious views how they see fit.
That's right. If you want to take a position that potentially causes young LGBTI people to feel less safe about themselves and they're sure about themselves, and ultimately that leads to very unfortunate consequences. Tim, take that view.
And I should add, he did say when he was asked about Flower's comments that he hadn't actually seen the social media posts yet, so he was kind of basing
that on... like Bill Shorten saying he didn't know what Julia Gillard had said, but he agreed with it?
Yeah.
Look, you know, I don't want to spend time on Israel Flower. I think it's a bit of static. I think the guy's an idiot. Briefly, Misha, Boris Rzeczewski, manslaughter, could be out. Was sentenced this week. He did plead guilty. He got a discount on his sentence for pleading guilty. Manslaughter, what did he get? 6 years?
He got nine.
Minimum of
with
six.
With a non-parole period of six.
And he's already served some, so...
Yeah, so some people are reporting he might be out within five.
Doesn't seem much of a sentence for killing someone, murdering them, dumping them in the bush. Doesn't seem a lot.
No, and there has been, to some extent, the predictable howls of outrage about that. And I guess one of the key issues is in the context of what the discussion we've been having as a society about domestic violence.
One woman a week,
you know,
is murdered
in
a domestic violence situation and or dies from, you know.
The fact that, you know, a woman's life has been lost and the cost, you know, of that, you know, to the man who is responsible for that loss of life is, you know, 6 to 9 years.
Mm.
People are... understandably outraged.
So do you know the legal framework behind that? Why it is that low? I don't know, I guess. Is there a reason why?
Yeah, so there's a few things. The first thing is we don't know how Boris committed the killing of
his wife.
So the first bit of that is because of that, it creates a challenge for sentencing, because normally in sentencing what you have to do is work within guidelines to say...
You know, the severity of the crime, you know, the amount of violence that was involved, you know, so there's a scale. So because they weren't able to determine the actual cause of death because the body had decomposed so much, pretty unpleasant subject, then the sentencing becomes a challenge.
That's right. And the second thing is he actually pleaded guilty to manslaughter, not murder.
Yeah.
So manslaughter is where you cause somebody's death, but there's not the same criminal intent.
Yeah.
So to murder somebody, you've got to either intend to kill them or intend to cause them grievous bodily harm. Mm. So basically it's a lesser charge that he was convicted on. The judge didn't have available the evidence of, you know, how the actual act was committed. And there is a discount for pleading guilty to the charge. So in that context, that was the sentence we ended up with. Now, in terms of sentencing guidelines, generally what you're looking at is there's a whole bunch of reasons why you sentence people. There's what they call specific deterrence, which is to stop, you know, that person doing that same thing again. There's general deterrence, so sending a message to the community that you don't want anybody to do that type of thing. There's community protection, you know, making people safe by putting people who are going to behave dangerously in jail, rehabilitation. And then there's one more which just momentarily eludes me, but it is sort of this idea of punishment as well, just actually making sure that somebody suffers a consequence for an action that hurts society. All those things have to be weighed, and then the judge has to work out if, you know, given the general sentencing guidelines, what's an appropriate penalty. It was a very difficult case in this instance, and I can understand why there's outrage, but I can also understand why we ended up with the outcome we did. So it looks like the DPP will probably appeal.
Well, yeah.
So we'll have to wait and see where that ends up.
Yeah, but I guess what's troubling to me about that is that I guess a lot of domestic violence survivors, the majority of them, go as far as to say don't actually report because they're worried about how the process will be, whether they'll get some sort of justice.
How it will play out.
Exactly. Yeah. If in this case, I guess, if people are seeing this and feeling like it's quite an unfair sentencing, I mean, by the legal framework, I understand, but if it's not heavy enough, it might prevent other people from coming forward. If it might similarly not, you know.
I mean, if the sentence had been longer and the judge had known, let's just assume the sentence was longer because the judge had, or the court, had some information about the extent of violence and more of the circumstances, and people still, you know, have a right to object to those sentences. But because we don't know, is it right? And because he hasn't spoken about it to the court, he hasn't volunteered any information, is it right that he gets a lesser sentence simply because we don't know those things. The thing is, he took his wife's life.
That's right.
You know, she didn't die from eating too much popcorn.
Yeah, one of the difficulties for the prosecutors was that in a sort of a pre-trial decision or early in the trial, the judge basically said, look, if you wanted to use evidence of his conduct after the murder to indicate his state of mind in committing the act, you actually can't do that.
Yeah.
And that's why we ended up with this manslaughter sort of charge, which is a lesser charge than murder. I think the question is, in circumstances where the accused or the person that's pleading guilty actually doesn't provide details of what actually happened, is the judge in sentencing entitled to assume the worst? Now, the judge in this instance said no, you know, he could not do that. What he had to do was sort of try to work out a fair determination without having the evidence, and that's what made it really hard.
I'm glad I'm not a judge.
Yeah, it's a tricky one.
I think it would be really difficult. Something some people have delivered a judgment on is the Richmond Safe Injecting Facility. Stephen Jolly, the City of Yarra councillor, well known, he's stood for the Socialists, hasn't
he? Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's had a public meeting or a couple of public meetings about it. We've had the director of the facility on air a couple of times talking about how it has saved lives. A very controversial issue for people that live in the electorate. Now, Matt,
yeah,
you live very close to this facility.
Yeah, maybe I think 100 metres away.
Okay, so what's your take?
Frankly, I've seen the benefit even in the short time that it's been there. I know before there was a safe injecting room, I guess naturally it was quite unsafe and not, I mean, just for myself, I mean, for people that wanted to use drugs, you know, just walking down the street, I'd often see, you know, used probably unsafe syringes on the ground that people would be using and things like this. But since that's been there, I haven't seen that. Like, it's been a real marked difference. And to me, it's just a testament to how important a facility like that is, because...
Is it a honeypot? Does it attract people?
Yeah. Oh, no, it does. Yeah, yeah, no. In the sense that, yes, 100%. When I walk past, I mean, they've got security there to make sure that, you know, the people keep their distance, just to make sure it's just for people that need to go there for their certain reason. But... in a good way. I mean, I think it's making sure that people aren't out on the streets subjecting themselves to something that might actually hurt them. I honestly, sincerely, in my opinion, it's made a really marked difference. Yeah. I mean, harm reduction is really important when it comes to safe injecting and drug use, and this is one of the main ways to do that. So
there's a pretty... There are other people who live nearby that have a different view.
Of course, yeah. And you mentioned, I think we've gotten invites to community consultations recently as well. And I'm aware it's a contentious issue. But that's my opinion, though.
Yeah, Misha.
Well, I think there was a meeting of 100 residents who were complaining about really a couple of issues. One of which is there's been reported, and I'm not quite sure if this has been confirmed, that the police had sort of a zone in which they weren't policing sort of certain types of drug offences. And there were claims that people were shooting up out in the open and there was a concern about what that was doing in the area. There's a couple of questions there, I guess, one of which is 100 people is not, you know, obviously the whole community. It's 100 people within the community who are concerned about it. And I think what's happened is they've extended the opening hours, and the idea is that that will make a difference in terms of making it... possible for more people to actually access the safe injecting room, which means there's less risk of people sort of injecting on the streets. Generally speaking, I think harm minimisation is an absolutely obvious and very sensible policy. Probably an even smarter policy setting is eventually trying to end the whole war on drugs idea and trying to actually deal with some sort of legalisation and treating drug addiction as a medical problem. But, you know, for now, it seems to me that what's been worked out seems to be a good compromise, and hopefully it will be successful.
And I know I'm not out on the streets all the time, but I mean, again, prior to there being this facility at the end of my street, I did see people quite regularly shooting up in public, and I haven't seen that since. Not that it doesn't happen, but to me, there is an obvious difference. So, I mean, it's even aside from that actual experience at the end of my street, I mean, I always was pro them anyway, but it's just, yeah, to me, it's a testament to how important they are.
Yeah, so we've had Nico, who's the executive medical director, Nico Clark, and you know, he has a lot of experience in this, particularly work in the World Health Organization. Look, it is a you know, some will say, you know, why are we allowing people to do something illegal? It's in a controlled environment. It's actually about harm minimisation. And I remind people that, you know, well-known bleeding heart liberal, and I'm being sarcastic there, Ken Lay, previous Victorian Police Commissioner, current chair of Ambulance Victoria, on this show, before the facility opened and the debate was being had, he supported it, and his words were, and I'll paraphrase, Macca, I can't see any compelling evidence as to why we shouldn't give this a go. We cannot arrest our way out of this problem. We need to try some different things. And this is part of that. I don't know if this is the answer, but the old way, you know, isn't the answer. It's totally, arresting our way out of it doesn't work. The war on drugs hasn't worked. You know, we have an epidemic of ICE and other really, really serious drugs in our community. This is mainly heroin. But, you know, we need to try something else. I feel for the people that live there, that they feel that the experience for them is not as good as they would like it to be. If it was impacting on my life, yes. In a negative way, I'd probably be going to those meetings. But I'd also say we need to give this a try.
And I'm curious. I mean, I should have went along to the meeting, but I'm curious to know where they were coming from, because, again, prior, I know that there was that area in Richmond that was known as kind of like the heroin quadrant, which had like the highest rates of, you know, injecting and that kind of stuff. But surely even the people that maybe are uneasy about there being a safe injecting facility have to understand or even be aware of the fact that there has been a drastic difference. I mean, for me, I know they haven't measured that yet, but to me, it's very notable and obvious, so...
Julian Assange, quickly. Peter Gresta has said Julian Assange is not a journalist, so why are we having this discussion about freedom of the press and blah, blah, blah? Misha.
Yes. okay, so the reason he said that is simply because journalism involves having a responsibility for what you publish, so it involves sort of a sifting process.
Oh, he's definitely not a journalist.
Yeah, whereas Assange's approach is sort of indiscriminate. It's basically putting everything out there, and there have been some negative consequences, including, for example, people who were informants on the Taliban being placed at risk, those types of things. So his argument basically is that if you are arguing that the Australian government should be doing more to support Assange against extradition to the US... that's not a press freedom issue. It would fall into another category. And to be honest, I think he's right. Now, that's not to say that what Assange does doesn't have a value necessarily, or there might not be a case for supporting him. But it's inherently, in my view, distinct from what we term as sort of freedom of the press issues or journalism issues.
Because, yeah, ultimately, I think, you know, there has been some significant... change has come from issues that WikiLeaks has raised, some real concerns, but also, you know, he's not, you know, he doesn't take responsibility for the material that he's published, and in a lot of cases he hasn't vetted it correctly or enough
at all,
you know, to take out, you know, if, you know, if I was an informer, if I was an informer to the security agencies, because I believed that there were some terrible things happening and I knew something about them and I could say something or report something that lessened that happening, and then my name then appeared, you know, in WikiLeaks as a result of that, and I was then put under threat for doing the right thing, then how is that right?
Well, that's right. And if you believe in radical transparency, I mean, one question is... WikiLeaks itself is very secretive. So,
oh, yeah.
So what you're saying is we believe that governments should have no right to secrecy whatsoever and everything should be entirely transparent. That's sort of the model. And then you're saying, but your own organisation doesn't live by that model. Now, I mean, there's sort of a logical inconsistency there. There are obviously circumstances in which people's identities need to be protected. And if that's the case... then surely we need to acknowledge that there are times when there are legitimate arguments for governments protecting information as well.
Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9. Just to close off on Julian Assange, he's not what I would call someone who has a high regard for the rule of law. In a lot of ways, he's probably a bit of an anarchist there. one might question whether or not he would get a fair trial in the United States with all the power of the state and the security apparatus against him, or in the UK. Norway is a different matter. And, you know, the allegation, the sexual assault allegation that was made against him, that was one of the reasons, because he said, oh, if I go to Norway, I'll get, you know, extradited. I think the justice system in Norway is pretty robust, as is the media and the oversight. Just because you're fearful of something else, Julian, you know, ultimately you have to be accountable for your actions. You might publish stuff that you're not accountable for. But that issue about avoiding his trial in Norway, to me, said to me a lot about his character.
In relation to Peter Grist's comments that you were mentioning earlier, Misha, has there been a lot of pushback to it? Like, are people generally agreeing with it? Are they?
I think a lot of people are very strong supporters of Assange, and they felt that Peter Grist was making a distinction that was a distinction that's important to journalists,
yeah,
but that a lot of people didn't have a lot of sympathy with. So I think there was some criticism. There's actually a piece in the Age newspaper today sort of arguing that. I mean, the one thing I would say is that what Assange is going to be charged with if he is extradited to the US is conspiring with a whistleblower. Now, that is concerning from a journalistic point of view,
yes,
from a press freedom point of view, because that act itself is an act that we all would have been, you know, guilty of in different circumstances,
yeah,
from time
absolutely
to time. So, I mean, that law in itself is a problem. And I think there are certainly arguments for Australia to, you know, oppose the extradition on those grounds. And there is a distinction in extradition treaties that's sometimes made between sort of criminal offences and other offences on the statute books that are more political of nature. So, I mean, I think there definitely is a case there, but the distinction that Peter Grist was making, which is what is and what isn't a journalist, is actually a really important one. And it's also important for this reason. Julian Assange's sort of radical model of radical transparency is the same as the model of unedited content that Facebook and Google and others have used to replace traditional journalism. And they have similarly been reluctant to take responsibility for the consequences of what they publish, whether it be, you know, live stream video, or whether it be dishonest or, you know, incorrect information. And I believe that everybody, anybody who puts information out into the public sphere, who uses the power of sort of one-to-many media communication, has to take responsibility for the consequences of what they do.
And dare I say, both of you gentlemen, who are editors of your respective publications, understand that obligation and that responsibility, that you do not, well, certainly knowingly, I know you go to great lengths to verify the information you publish and to give an opportunity for a response. And you would not, I don't think, would publish something that is going to put someone at severe risk.
Of course.
No.
So there's a big difference. There's a big difference.
I mean, I just don't think you get to argue that the rules don't apply to me. You know,
yeah.
Just basically, I am exempt from any responsibility for the consequences of my actions. I think that's the problem.
Has Scott Morrison weighed in? I think he said something like he wasn't going to do Assange any favours, something along those lines. Am I making that up?
No, you probably aren't, but I'm not quite sure exactly. I'd need to go and check the record to know exactly what he said. It's sort of been very lukewarm, I think, what we've seen so far.
Donald Trump.
Or
Tronald Dump. The Mueller report, you know, the Donald says he's been completely and utterly exonerated. You know, there's nothing to see here. Already a Democrat, a couple of Democrats have said they still think he needs to be impeached. What this has done is it's actually changed, I hate that term, but the paradigm for political debate and what's acceptable in US politics. And influence, you know, so the fact is, Mueller says the Russians tried really hard and did influence the US election. So what action do we take, what action is taken against Russia ultimately?
That's a good question. Well, I mean, obviously there's an issue for the US legal system in that it's got no jurisdiction in Russia, so it's not something really that Mueller can deal with. That's a broader sort of political sort of foreign affairs question. I think the interesting thing with the Mueller investigation was he was quite specific to say that he didn't exonerate Trump. He didn't have enough evidence to exonerate Trump. He said he would have if he could have, but nor could he you know, provide something sufficient to sort of found an indictment or some sort of further action.
It's interesting when you say that, you know, you could say there is, and there's two ways of doing it, there is not sufficient evidence to indict, and no, I don't have enough evidence to exonerate you, which is like, you know, saying there's a difference between being found not guilty and being acquitted.
That's right.
And yeah. Trump has not, you know, he has not been found not guilty, and he has not been acquitted because he wasn't indicted. Simply, there was not sufficient evidence to exonerate him. But, you know, you read between the lines, Mueller's saying there's something here and it smells a bit.
Yeah, that's right. But I think, you know, the net effect of this is going to be that this issue, to some extent, will go away now. I mean, it's been exhausted. It's unlikely. It would be almost impossible to impeach him on the basis
of the report
of where we are now.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things is, just reading some of the reporting on it, the way in which the brazen nature of his conduct has actually helped him. Because so much of his attempt to thwart the Mueller investigation was public, he sort of also got away with not being found to have, you know, attempted to pervert the course of justice or impede the investigation sort of formally, because it was so sort of
he just likes to be a pervert. he doesn't need to pervert.
And if you do it on Twitter, it's not a secret conspiracy, is it?
No, that's right. Yeah, like it's secret amongst him and his 13 million followers or how many he has. Quick question from a listener. He said, ScoMo has sprinted out of the blocks making tax the major subject of the campaign. If you were a media advisor to the ALP, both of you, hypothetically, would you? Because people think I am. Hypothetically, would you advise the? What would you advise the ALP to do to change the narrative?
Oh, that's a good question. There's two things. One of which is obviously the sort of self-interest aspects of tax. I don't know about everybody else, but I certainly look at those tables and see how it's going to impact me or not. And I'm sure a lot of people do. I think we're talking very, very small incremental differences between the parties. Like, it's sort of complicated. You've got to look at all different salary ranges. And,
yes.
But ultimately, it's not a massive change. So I'm not quite sure it's going to be that powerful an issue to begin with, in that if you look at it with any sort of level of scrutiny, you're not going to go, oh, one party's massively better than the other for me.
I don't think it'll be... You know, the tax issue, yes, resonates with certain groups, but I think, you know, health and education and asylum seekers and climate change is where the battle is.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be what are you going to do in a bigger picture sense, because this is very detailed and the differences are very tiny.
Mm. Listener here says, Julian Assange is a libertarian and acts like an anarchist. Well, one would say libertarians are anarchists.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure if the... Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think there's a distinction between libertarian and anarchist, and he's probably more on the anarchist end of the spectrum.
Yeah, libertarians don't have a good name. People like David Lionholm and others. or modern liberals. They like being thoroughly modern Millie. A modern liberal.
Modern liberal?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Oh, some are saying they're modern liberals. You know thoroughly modern Millie, that musical...
No, I don't.
No. Sorry. This is ringing no bells.
All right, I'm showing my age. You'll need to Google that. Look, we're almost out of time. Misha from The Conversation, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sure yourself and all your journos are going to be pretty busy in the run-up to the election. I know Matt is. He's out there searching for LGBTI angles.
Just drowning in LGBTI content. Although it's like you said earlier that, we're trying to bring as much visibility to the LGBTI issues because obviously politicians aren't necessarily going to do that. So, yeah.
No, they like to throw us a bone occasionally, you know, to think, okay, look, you know, we'll give a bit of money here.
Mm.
Just imagine if our community received the same funding and services support as the amount of population we represent and the amount of tax we pay.
Yep.
That's probably why they don't do it, because it would mean taking money off other people.
Radical.
I'm an anarchist. No, I'm not.
Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, proudly sponsored by Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.